Good morning, Council. While you're getting settled, I know we're going to have to send some of the gallery downstairs to view the oral argument. But while you are getting settled, I want to first thank you for being prompt as the notice of oral argument directs you. This is one of those days where there's a glitch in the case that was scheduled for 10:40, and I appreciate you being here and ready to proceed this morning. You will each have 15 minutes to present your arguments. Counselor for appellant, you will have 5 minutes also for rebuttal. You may be seated if you'd like to. You're both familiar with our procedures. We are recording this hearing for making an audio record, and that is the only recording that is permitted. The podium can be raised or lowered to suit your needs. I'm trying to think if I've missed anything else. I will give the group that is going down to the auditorium a couple of minutes to get in place so that they don't miss any of your or the appellant. We'll wait a couple of minutes. Time always moves slowly when you're waiting. I think we will be ready to go ahead then, Counsel for Appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Richmond. I represent Matthew Ecker. This court should reverse Matt's conviction because in this circumstantial evidence case, the state failed to negate the reasonable hypothesis that Alexandra Penig died by suicide. Two medical examiners agreed that given the contact gunshot wound to Alex's left temple and a bullet track that went from back to front with no sign of resistance from Alex to prevent being shot in the head execution style, it was impossible to determine whether this was a suicide or a homicide. What we know is that Alex was a woman in turmoil. She had attempted suicide several years earlier. She had recently been fired from her job as a nurse. She was having a crisis of confidence. She was on probation for drunk driving, but was still drinking to excess.
Counsel, can I just break in with a question? What is the precise circumstance proved as to whether and how much blood was on the victim's hands? Because there's testimony from the responding officer, there's photographs. I know there's a reference in Dr. Mills's autopsy report. How would you characterize the circumstance proved as to that issue?
Dr. Mills' report, and I believe Dr. Thomas testified about it, was there was scant blood on the victim's left hand. And Dr. Thomas testified that that would be consistent with blowback.
And is that aspect of Dr. Thomas's testimony a circumstance proved? I mean, clearly there was a dispute. The medical examiners both agreed that the manner of death was undetermined. Beyond that, I would say it was a contested issue how much of the rest of the testimony from Dr. Thomas and Dr. Mills would be credited. And by the jury's verdict that it was a homicide, doesn't that mean that the rest of Dr. Thomas's testimony is not a circumstance proved?
Well, Dr. Mills obviously was familiar with the amount of blood on the victim's hand and never took the position that that precluded the possibility of suicide. And I mean, she is familiar with the concept of blowback. She did not testify that the scant amount of blood on her hand was inconsistent with suicide. So I don't think that there was disagreement about the state of her hand somehow being conclusive one way or the other. Where I would agree with you is with respect to what the defense characterized as slide bite on the left thumb, which clearly there was a difference of opinion between the two experts, and the jury clearly did not agree with the premise that that wound to the thumb was slide bite, and I have not relied on that as one of the circumstances proved. But I think that what would be fair to say from the record is that both experts agreed that the splattered or scantily splattered blood on the left hand could be consistent with suicide.
And then as a follow-up, am I remembering right that Dr. Mills testified that in her view it was inconsistent with suicide?
No, Dr. Mills said that there were certain aspects of this case that were inconsistent with suicide, but what she was referring to were things like the fact that Matt admitted to having moved the gun. She said she never saw a suicide where someone moved the gun.
And that's a circumstance proved, would you agree, that testimony?
That he moved the gun. Yes.
And that the movement of the gun is, in the view of the medical examiner, inconsistent with suicide.
I guess it's a circumstance proved that that would be unusual, but, I mean, it's certainly not inconsistent with suicide in the way that, ballistics evidence that the shot was fired from across the room would be inconsistent with suicide. I would say that sort of anecdotal evidence is more of an inference than a circumstance proved.
Can I ask you a more general question about your insufficiency argument? Are you contending the circumstances proved do not support a reasonable inference of guilt? Or is your argument that they also would support an inference, reasonable inference of innocence?
I think both. I would say that my argument includes both of those things, although the emphasis is on the latter, that the state has not negated a reasonable inference of innocence. But in addition, what the state has done on appeal is just pointed to isolated facts and said, well, the sink was dry and her hand was too clean, without ever positing a theory of prosecution to explain the circumstances proved. So at trial, the state had a convoluted theory, which was not repeated on appeal, that Matt somehow crashed the bathroom door open with his shoulder so forcefully that it broke the door, and yet it only opened 3 or 4 inches. And then while they were pushing against the door, he stuck his hand in the door blindly and somehow managed to get a shot exactly into her temple. But even though he was in front of her, it was going from back to front. So his hand was sort of like this. His hand went past her temple and then came back.
I acknowledge, if you want to characterize that, as a complicated theory, a convoluted theory. Wasn't that for the jury to decide whether the circumstances proved would support that or some other theory consistent with guilt?
Well, that's what the jury did, but this court has made, and the Supreme Court has made very, very clear in circumstantial evidence cases that the inferences drawn by the jury do not receive any deference. So, yes, the jury found those inferences consistent with guilt, but because there was no direct evidence that it happened the way I just described, and which I think the physical evidence somewhat negates, this court does not defer to those inferences, but decides on its own.
We defer to the circumstances proved, right? The facts that support the jury's finding of guilt and the evidence adduced by the state that it is not inconsistent with the jury's decision, right? Isn't that how the circumstantial evidence review standard works?
You defer to, yes, in determining the circumstances proved, where there are disputes in the evidence, you opt for those facts that support the verdict. But here, I would say other than the slide bite, there were no disputes as to the facts, only as to the inferences to be drawn from those facts. There was no dispute as to where Alex's body landed in the bathroom. One inference is, therefore, the door was open. Another inference is that her leg slid on the mat when he forced open the door.
But is that the stage that the reviewing court makes the inferences? Or is it the fact that the reviewing court identifies all of the circumstances, proves, looks at them in totality, and then decides whether there's an inference consistent with innocence?
Yes, I agree with that.
I'm not sure that we have evidence of the placement of the body. We have testimony from officers that it would have been difficult for the door to have been closed at the time of the shot, given the placement of the body. So I'm not sure that it's our job to then make an inference of innocence from that particular circumstance proved, as opposed to gathering them all together and asking the broader question. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to draw the inferences globally. I mean, I think inferences work by, you know, one piece of evidence at a time, but I agree with you that the analysis still is a totality of the circumstances. But in this case, I mean, with respect to the position of the body, there are other circumstances, including the fact that her right foot is wedged up against the wall. The door is parallel to her right leg. Both legs are on the bath mat. And typically, there were two bath mats, two rugs in that bathroom. One was along the tub. The other one was crumpled up in the middle of the floor. Typically, that second one would be along the vanity so that you would be standing on it when you're at the sink. I think all of those circumstances support the inference that her legs moved when he crashed open the door. And at least what I would say is the fact of the position of her body does not negate the rational theory of innocence, and together with the other circumstances proved that I've mentioned, which support the theory that this was a suicide, including the fact that her DNA was found not only on the gun, but on the holster, which was across the room. The state has not offered any explanation for those facts. And so whether we characterize the theory as convoluted or not,
are those facts some that would be circumstances proved?
That her DNA was on the holster?
Right.
Yes, that's a circumstance proved. There was no dispute. It was the state's experts that said.
In what way does that support the verdict is, I guess, my question.
It doesn't, well.
So then it's not, I mean, that's the rub about circumstances proved.
No, Your Honor, the circumstances proved include those facts which are not disputed, that are presented by the state, regardless of whether they support I would say that they support inferences of both guilt and innocence. And so it is a circumstance proved. Certainly, the fact that she at some point had handled the holster does not preclude the possibility that this was a murder, but it also supports that it could have been a suicide. There's a case, State versus Colgrove, Minnesota Supreme Court, in which it was a murder in which the defendant was on meth. Was using meth so heavily that the evidence was that he was suffering from paranoid delusions, and he argued based on that he did not have a sufficient intent. And on appeal, the state said, well, you can't consider the paranoid delusions because that doesn't support the verdict. And the court said he could have paranoid delusions and still have known that he was killing someone, or it could also support the verdict, support innocence. And so it is a circumstance proved that her fingerprints or DNA on the holster is not like an alibi, which is irreconcilably in conflict with the verdict.
But I think I agree with you that the evidence of her DNA on the holster was a circumstance proved. But, I mean, in Colgrove, as I recall, once the Supreme Court made that particular point about the delusions, it still looked at the circumstances proved in their entirety and affirmed the conviction, right?
Correct, yes.
So I still come back to the difficulty for me with your position is we still have the evidence of inconsistent statements, the very unusual fact of moving the gun. We still have the door hatch under the body. We still have the state's medical examiner testimony. When we look at all of those in totality, I still am having a hard time understanding how there is a rational inference of innocence.
Well, first of all, we also have, I would say the most compelling circumstance proved is this was a contact wound to the temple with no sign of resistance. This is a woman who has attempted suicide in the past. This is a woman in a downward spiral who has claimed that she has no hope about life. A wound track from back to front, even though Matt supposedly was standing in front of her. Her DNA on the holster. So let's suppose, I see my time is up. Could I?
You can wrap up quickly and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I would, as I said in my reply brief, even if the door was open, even if Matt was mistaken or lying about that, as in Isaac, that does not negate the reasonable hypothesis of innocence, and therefore it's our position that the evidence was insufficient. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. Ms. Penig suffered a gunshot wound to her left temple and died in the early morning hours of December 16, 2022. Appellant was the only person with her when she died. Appellant's claim that Ms. Penig committed suicide is merely a claim that the jury rejected. And the evidence that appellant asserts in support of that claim was also rejected by the jury. The circumstances proved, when viewed as a whole, render his suicide claim unreasonable. When determining the circumstances proved in this case, this court winnows down the evidence produced at trial to a subset of facts that are consistent with the verdict, and it rejects and excludes any evidence that was inconsistent with the verdict. When that crucial step is taken, and it is crucial because it preserves the jury's role as fact finder, it preserves the jury's role as the determiner of credibility, the jury's role of weighing the evidence. When those circumstances proved, when those are identified, then this court looks to see, is there any reasonable or rational hypothesis other than guilt?
Counsel, this question is a little bit apart from the particular two steps of the circumstantial evidence test, but I mean, it does concern me a little bit in this case, to the point of your opposing counsel, that it's hard to understand exactly how this happened, consistent with what the state's theory was. I mean, in that it was this close contact wound, no defensive wounds, hard to tell whether it doesn't appear to have much of a motive or provocation, reaching around the door in that manner. Can you just help me understand, is that the state's theory about what happened?
Yes, and you know, just to back up for a second, you know, the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant intentionally fired the shot. The state does not need to prove exactly how it happened, because no one was there. We have no witnesses to tell us exactly what happened, except for appellant himself. But yes, our theory at trial and remains that there was a struggle over the door. She ran to the door. She was trying to, you know, protect herself in the bathroom. He had the gun. He was on the outside of the bathroom door. You know, so at some point he forced the door open. So she had shut the door. He forced the door open. There was a struggle over the bathroom door. And in that time, he reached around. And so when they're right on the other side of a door from each other, they're in close proximity. If she's using her hands to defend herself by trying to close the door on him, and he's able to reach around and her head is right there. And if she's, you know, leaning this way, perhaps, that can explain the back-to-front trajectory. So that was the theory presented at trial. That's what the jury heard. That's what the jury credited by its guilty verdict. And there are many...
How do you explain the no gun residue on his hands or his clothing?
Sure. So you know, one theory is that is the door protected, you know, or kind of the way that the gun residue fell due to the placement of the door. It didn't fall on him. The other is he said he washed his hands. He could have quickly, you know, rinsed his hands in the sink. So those are kind of the two theories. And more importantly, there are many circumstances proved that render the claim of suicide unreasonable, and so it excludes any hypothesis other than guilt. A few of those, Ms. Penig was right-handed, and yet she was shot on the left side of her head. She was not familiar with firearms. She was vegan. She did not hunt. She didn't know how to operate firearms, and so it's unreasonable to infer that she would use her non-dominant hand to shoot herself. The position of the legs straddling the door, her left leg was in such a position where the door could not swing freely, and so it's unreasonable to infer that the door was forced open after she had fallen.
If we look at a circumstance proof that the manner of death was undetermined, and a circumstance proved that she had sent text messages that day, or maybe it was the day before, I don't recall, saying she didn't feel hopeful about life. Why isn't, and then, you know, no gunshot residue, why aren't those sufficient to support an inference of innocence?
So a few things, I think mainly those are a few isolated circumstances proved, but this court must look in totality, look at all the circumstances together to determine what's reasonable. Within those text messages, you know, that message about not feeling hopeful about life at this moment was back and forth about job prospects and job interviews. Those text messages show that she had been participating in job interviews, and she had another interview scheduled for the next day. She had also spoken to a close friend about attending that friend's wedding the following summer. So she was looking to the future, and so that's part of the circumstances proved, part of the context. And you know, to opposing counsel's point, you know, the Colgrove case, you know, I would agree that, you know, those circumstances, her mental health struggles in the past, some of those things are circumstances proved, and the jury heard them, could consider them. They're not inconsistent with guilt. But just like Colgrove, considering those viewed as a whole, still the only reasonable inference here is of appellant's guilt.
And what is your position on, is there anything from Dr. Thomas's testimony that is a circumstance proved other than the manner of death being undetermined? I mean, are parts of, you know, I don't know that her testimony that, you know, it was more consistent with suicide. Is that necessarily actually inconsistent with the verdict?
I would say, I would say that it is inconsistent with the verdict, and I did not include Dr. Thomas's testimony in my circumstances proved. The jury's job is to credit testimony and weigh the testimony. She was a defense-retained expert. She was impeached with, you know, the rates that she was compensated for her opinions. She also, and it was, came out in the testimony that she did not actually view the body herself. She didn't actually conduct an autopsy. She viewed photographs of Dr. Mills' autopsy. She read scholarly articles that then Dr. Mills testified were not helpful to determining manner of death. And so based in looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, the jury did not credit the vast majority of Dr. Thomas's testimony, as would be the state's position. As to, and that reminds me of your other question of the manner of death being undetermined by the medical examiner. That is a circumstance proved, but we don't use medical examiners to establish guilt. It's just one circumstance proved. We don't need her to say homicide for us to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. So the fact that they weren't able to determine the manner of death based on the autopsy and the evidence they had at that moment in time does not mean that the jury could not go on, view all the evidence as a whole, and determine beyond reasonable doubt that appellant was guilty.
I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I think it's not the typical homicide, I would say, that has medical examiner testimony that the manner of death was undetermined. And so with that, I would say it certainly means that the state, to meet its burden of proof, has to marshal some pretty other significant evidence.
Sure, and I don't think we wouldn't shy away from that. We didn't shy away from that at trial. I can point to, you know, the metal ring piece from the door. So was found under her body. It was found under her right shoulder. And so that supports a reasonable inference that the door was forced open before she died. And, you know, the appellant's story that he manipulated her head to try to render aid is not a circumstance proved. That does not go forward in this case because the jury rejected his story and his statements. So there is no reasonable explanation for why the metal ring would end up under her body, except for that he forced the door open before he shot her. The fact that the gun was very clean, there wasn't much blood splatter on the gun as well as her hand. The fact that appellant's DNA was not on his own gun when he said he had handled it, and yet his DNA wasn't present, is a reasonable inference that he cleaned the gun and then placed it in her hand. The wound to her thumb, as talked about with opposing counsel, Dr. Mills' testimony, which was credited by the jury, was that that is not indicative of trigger or slide bite because of the direction that the wound was, and that it also was a postmortem wound. So that is not consistent with suicide. Also the testimony from the people who knew her best, her father, her friend, her boyfriend, her neighbor, all establishing that she had an aversion to firearms, that she did not know how to operate them, that she cared about her appearance. And so, and all of those things made it unreasonable to think that she would shoot herself in her head. Again, and I think Judge Bond, you referenced motive potentially, and you know, as that's not an element that we need to prove, you know, there are facts elicited at trial that the jury heard and used in determining guilt. You know, that appellant and Ms. Penig had been in a extramarital relationship for 2 years. He had given her $28,000 over a year and a half to financially support her. He was in massive credit card debt. His cards were maxed out. She was seeing someone else and talking to her other boyfriend about moving in together. She texted him when she got into an argument with that other boyfriend, and he drove. The appellant drove hours down to St. Paul to be with her, and yet that night, the third bar they ended up at, her other boyfriend, she wanted to go there because her other boyfriend was there. There was an altercation. The other boyfriend punched appellant in the face, knocking him out. That is all what transpired immediately before coming back to her apartment, and she was dead an hour later. So it doesn't prove a direct motive, but it's circumstances that the jury considered in figuring out what transpired that night.
So it sounds a little, I mean, would you agree that the motive evidence is not, it's not an element anyway, but it's not particularly strong in this case, I would say. Do you
agree? And that we don't need to prove exactly what it was. I also think that's not uncommon in these kind of domestic situations, where a lot of, and especially in a extramarital relationship where it maybe wasn't as public or, there weren't a lot of witnesses to their relationship or what had gone on. So there's just a lot of unknowns in that part of her story. trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to touch on before I close. I guess just in conclusion, I just want to remind the court of the standard of review that the first step really does defer to the jury as the fact finder, and that is vital to this test. And then the second step, really looking at the circumstances in totality and determining what is rational, what is reasonable. And in this case, we submit to you that the circumstances proved were consistent with appellant's guilt and inconsistent with any rational theory except guilt. If there aren't any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Richman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
We don't have to prove that this was a suicide. The state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't. We have two medical examiners who were unable to make that determination. While I agree with the state that we look at the circumstances in totality, when the state says we don't have to explain how this happened, that is the opposite of looking at this in its totality. Looking at it in its totality is presenting a plausible theory for how this happened consistent with the circumstances proved, and for the reasons that we've discussed, they haven't done that here. Wildly pointing a gun and it going to against the victim's temple, and the victim doesn't duck, doesn't move her head, doesn't push the arm away, it makes no sense. While it's true, the jury accepted the state's theory. Again, there is no direct evidence supporting it, and so the jury relied on inferences. Inferences that this court gives no deference. The state at trial conceded the fact, equivocal nature of the evidence in this case when it said in closing, there are no people who can determine whether this is a homicide or whether this is a suicide. That is the definition of a reasonable doubt. But what the prosecutor then did is said, that's why we have a jury. You go and flip a coin. That is basically what happened in this case. There are definitely suspicious circumstances on both sides. I concede that. But where the position of the body is completely consistent with her legs having been pushed to the side when the door was forced open, the DNA evidence, the absence of any gunshot residue on Matt's arm and his shirt, the scattered blood on Alex's hand. The court's role in this case is not to decide, and the jury's role is not to decide which theory seems more plausible, which theory do we believe. The question is, has the state negated beyond a reasonable doubt the possibility that this woman who admitted to a lack of hope about life 24 hours before this happened, have they negated the possibility that this was a suicide?
But it's not just the possibility, right? It's a reasonable possibility.
I think that where this woman has attempted suicide in the past, has expressed, if you had someone, it is certainly not unreasonable that this woman who has attempted suicide in the past and is in a downward spiral would have, having seen her boyfriend with another woman at this bar, having had a violent encounter with him earlier that day, realizing that he's not going to move in with her, realizing that Matt is not going to leave his wife, she's completely alone, grabbing Matt's gun and saying, "You don't care about me enough, I'm going to kill myself." And Matt trying to force open the door, knocking her legs. There is nothing about that that is unreasonable. The state did not, it's striking that in the interrogation of Matt, the detective said, "We're going to get you for first-degree murder, because the medical examiners are going to look at this. There are going to be a dozen reasons forensically that your theory makes no sense." And then the reality is that the experts cannot find any reason that it makes no sense. None. And that suggests that not only is Matt a cold-blooded killer, he's also a criminal mastermind. The state's theory makes no sense. They have failed to negate the reasonable hypothesis that this was a suicide, and for those reasons, we ask the court to reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments today and briefing. It's a tough case on its facts, and we appreciate the level of attention you've both given to it. And we will take the matter under advisement, issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. We will take a short recess to see whether and if we will be recalling the last case. So we will stand in recess.
All rise.